The midterm elections are coming up, and net neutrality is one of the key issues. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with a conservative analyst about her new research on just how important tech policy is in off-year elections.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. As always, the midterm elections are coming up, and politics seems to be a thing this year. And when it comes to policies around the tech industry, it plays out two ways in election years. Some issues are emotional, and some issues are so bipartisan that they're just not good for voter turnout. I mean, who gets hyped when everyone agrees, right?
Tech policy will tend to be conducted in the off years when there's not a competition, because it's when you can get things done and people cooperate. But now there's exceptions, of course, in this midterm, because we have some very highly politicized issues around net neutrality, online privacy, to some extent on broadband.
That's the author of a new think piece about tech policy and the midterm elections. Net neutrality is one of those emotional issues that can, and I would offer will, motivate younger voters. You remember net neutrality.
At risk, the basic principle of net neutrality.
Net neutrality.
Net neutrality.
Yes. Net neutrality. The only two words that promise more boredom in the English language are featuring Sting.
And a Republican congressman has proposed a bill called the 21st Century Internet Act. If it passes, then the FCC would not have control over the net, but would only be the regulator of the net. One set of rules for all that would ban internet providers from blocking and throttling websites. It also bans paid prioritization, also known as the fast lanes on the internet. That tees up this week's show about tech policy and the midterms. My conversation with the analyst and author of the most recent think piece about the topic starts now.
Rosalind Leighton, I'm a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C.
We have the midterms coming up a little bit later this year. Everybody's kind of on pins and needles about this one. Let's talk about your most recent paper, which is Tech Policy, Its Effect and Impact or Not Impact on this midterm. Let's just go 30,000-foot view right off the top.
This is really a different time, and people really see this midterm as kind of their referendum on the president and his political party. So there's a variety of issues that will appear. And so what I wanted to do with this paper was to discuss, will technology policy be a part of that? And even though many say it will be, is it empirically so?
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about technology policy, which is goes back to Alexander Hamilton, actually. He wanted to mechanize the American economy as a way to get rid of slavery. And that was really his view that, you know, if we industrialized, we wouldn't have need to treat people so terribly. It was really a brilliant idea. And to bring it down to where we are today, which is tech economy, it's huge. It's growing a larger part of our GDP. It's a big part of the economy of California, Silicon Valley, as you know. But obviously, we have different parts of America have a different view of these things. The tech workforce is more scattered across the United States than people realize. So the smallest part of the employment is in Silicon Valley. Most of it is in other states, Texas, Florida, Illinois, New York, Michigan, and so on. And sometimes that's what we'll forget.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, most of the tech policy issues are largely bipartisan. There were historically a lot of agreement between Republicans and Democrats. A big part of tech policy is the military. So it's not a good issue to have during an election because you can't distinguish yourself from your opponent.
I see.
So tech policy will tend to be conducted in the off years when there's not a competition, because it's when you can get things done and people cooperate. But now there's exceptions, of course, in this midterm, because we have some very highly politicized issues around net neutrality, online privacy, to some extent on broadband. But the other issue is, of course, tax reform, because that has had a huge impact for a large number of tech companies, mm-hmm. because they invest a lot in the U.S. economy. So you can argue, to the extent that if they have a tax cut and they invest more in the economy, if they hire more workers, if they pay people more, that is a net positive. The other thing that the paper shows is that there's really a competition of ideas between Republicans and Democrats in some areas of tech policy. Democrats really see science and technology as a pillar of their party. They see a role that the government needs to play in the tech economy. It's responsible to provide the education, select the employment, and so on. It's a rather centralized view, whereas the Republican view is really, there's not really so many silos. You should just have a good general policy across the board, and that will support all the industries, whatever they may be.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two fundamentally different views. And what has been good historically is both of those views were competing. So you could probably say military, which takes up a huge part of our research and development in the United States, the majority of a lot of our spending, that's been largely bipartisan, even though we now have entrepreneurs who can, you know, billionaires who can invest in their own space program and that sort of thing.
Okay.
But in any case, as we come up to the midterm, I wanted to use this paper to help people understand there's a substance of tech policy, which is really going into details on things like spectrum policy, 5G,
right,
cybersecurity, lots of technical issues, which doesn't really get much play in the media. And then there's the emotional or the politicized level of tech policy, which gets a lot of attention.
Right.
And the idea is for the readers to step back and say, well, wait a second, am I just being, you have someone trying to push my buttons because this issue I have some concerns about, as opposed to, you know, what's the real substance that we're trying to talk about? Both parties like to play wedge issues. Wedge
right.
issues are where you will try to exploit the divisions in your opponent's party. So you could say the Republicans used it on, for example, gay marriage. Democrats use it on different immigration issues. So these are tactics that are deployed, and not saying that there's not merit there for the different positions, but these are exploited in a heightened way to win votes at the ballot box.
Let's push each other's buttons on net neutrality towards the end of the interview. Let's be quants until we get to that point. What did your research
right.
show as far as anticipating for the midterm voter participation this year in 2018? Are we going to see a surge, or are we going to see another depression?
It's really the multi-billion dollar question, because there are a variety of political scientists who are trying to predict the polls. What I can tell you that the research shows is that tech policy doesn't move people to the polls. That what moves people are the perennial issues, the economy, education, security, immigration, you know, these big ticket discussions. Technology is nowhere in the top 10. You know,
okay.
people care more about the environment in general. That's an important issue, but still not as much as, you know, the economics or the security. So first of all, that's just a given. Now, what's interesting is, you know, according to New York Times, the Democrats have a strategy to get millennial voters out and use net neutrality as a tech policy issue, along with marijuana legalization mm-hmm. and gun control. And that's the kind of three-legged stool. Now, it's interesting because those are all positions that a lot of millennials would support. But what is the wild card is that historically millennials have not come out in the midterms.
Right.
And I find this when I talk to a lot of millennials, they don't want to vote. They don't want to stand at the polls. They don't do an absentee ballot. It's risky because millennials are not yet on board with doing this voting process the way, for all intents and purposes, old people are, right? They
right.
have nothing better to do.
Right.
They're saying they study all day long and then they go to the polls and so on. So it's very different. But what's the interesting thing is there is a competition right now. Which party can activate millennials? Historically, the Democrats have done a better job. We're seeing, though, some of the gaps are narrowing. And what I would say is also risky is that a number of Democratic Party policies are very, they have a heightened emotional, or what you might call a symbolic element, which can definitely get people to come out and protest and so on. But will it translate to people stand in line at the voting booth? Now, I'm sure for them, they hope so. Now, there have been some elections, for example, Virginia, the governor of Virginia, they had a huge surge from millennials. If that was translated nationally, that would be a huge benefit. I mean, it would be pivotal. But the long-term issue is whichever party can win on activating millennials for their ideas, they will win at the polls, because millennials as a group are going to be bigger than any other demographic. So just the numbers of millennials will crush it.
The engagement numbers for tech, let's say, you know, if you could put your smartphone in your hand, let's call that just tech for a second, with millennial
right.
engagement and activation and usage, you would think that they would be a little more attuned to tech policy being important to them. But what you're saying is that it doesn't seem to be really motivating yet, or at least it doesn't seem to be so far.
Right. Well, that is actually one of the other things that we found. We have all had this, or I'm saying we, the academic world, we're very excited about this notion of digital democracy because it was like, oh, wow, we've lowered the cost of information. Everybody can get information. They can make more decisions and so on. But what's happened is essentially all these tools, they actually empower those who already have power,
right,
in the sense that the people who are already educated and digitally inclined are more apt to use them. And the poor people who are already disenfranchised, they don't end up being any better off because they never sort of cross the chasm. And so that is actually something that is perennially distressing to me. It's very sad that we have made the cost of information so low, and it should be able to get everybody to vote and so on, but it doesn't happen. So you have a kind of digital elite class, if you will, that essentially what's happening is the reflection of their preferences in the ballot box, not everybody in general.
You really teed that one up for me, Rosalind, because there's a trigger word in your paper, and that's elite. You mentioned the tech elite several times in there, and I'm reading this and I'm preparing for this interview, and I'm like, is she talking about me? Who what is your working definition of tech elite?
Okay, but I didn't invent it.
I understand.
Greg Fahrenstein, brilliant guy, who's looked at, he did a survey of what's essentially there's a technology class of entrepreneurs, of investors, of tech workers who are extremely intelligent. They have, they're well-to-do, they have money, and they had a set of preferences, which are, on the one hand, liberal redistributive policies, but on the other, maybe wanting limited regulation.
Right.
So it's a kind of a strange it's like a schizophrenic combination. It's a bipolar combination.
It is.
It's very different than, you could say maybe a far left Democrat or a far right Republican conservative. But in any case, there is a tech industry in the United States. It's a huge part of our economy. There's a big tech workforce. And we obviously will be concerned about how are the goods and services produced in our economy? How do we make that? What are the best policies to realize that?
Okay.
And there are different approaches to getting there. But the tech elite in certain places will have a specific set of policies in mind. But what I predict is that because our economy, because technology is becoming more diverse or more institutionalized across the country in different ways, and especially as we look towards 5G, new industries will start to use technology, like the mining industry, or the energy industry has become more information centric, or the traditional manufacturing or automobiles. A lot of these old line industries become more data centric. It may change from the Silicon Valley view, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. So the set of stakeholders is becoming more broad.
Yes.
So that means that maybe our conversation is, not just about what's good for Silicon Valley. Every industry has become very IT-centric. So telemedicine, for example, what will be the best? How do we realize telemedicine for everybody? I mean, there will be a very different view about how we do that, and that may change our tech policy conversation.
I think, let's put the train on that track. Let's follow the economic track for a minute, because you make some great points about policy differences between the left and right, whatever. Okay, that's fine. But they both have to be built on reality. And the reality is access to broadband and 5G, because that is the next wave, like you said. Now, because 20% disruption within a sector, you have been disrupted until it gets to about 20%. But that's the internet. That was the internet factor. Now it's spreading it out, right? It's about infrastructure.
Right.
And so what did you find in your research around 5G? Let's start with 5G, and then let's talk about broadband accessibility.
Right. So for your listeners who I'm sure people admit they haven't heard about 5G, it's the next generation of mobile wireless technology. We have 4G. The United States has been the leader in the 4G economy. It's about $500 billion. We have a million people employed just in 4G-related technologies. Similarly with 5G, it will be another quantum leap. I mean, it will be another million workers, another set of hundreds of billions of dollars to our economy. So it's the next threshold. Now, it's not overnight. It will be gradual, but it's important. And the difference today is it's not like the past where it was just us doing 4G. Nobody else had 4G. It was just the United States. Now we have China, and we have a global competition the way that we didn't before. And we also have a number of international regulations and things that we didn't have before. So the stakes are higher because the Chinese can eat our lunch in terms of they have their versions of platforms and their, they have their thing of what they want to do. So here we are, of course, a big economy, a lot of success. we have different, this policy is playing out in different cities. So if you take California, you've got Sacramento and Los Angeles are really leading when it comes to 5G. And that is the interesting thing about San Francisco. Well, we thought, okay, Bay Area is always going to be at the forefront. It's not on 5G.
Right.
In fact, you know, it's behind what LA is probably the top in the world. They have got a complete public-private partnership, which has already been launched, and they're off and running. They're integrating their systems for the cities. They have a variety of different corporate partners. They have Citizen Center, data program. So many of the problems or issues they've already worked out, and they're off and running. Sacramento, similarly, where they have already doing citywide Wi-Fi program. They've already worked out all the kinks around, you know, how do we get access to the poles? You know, pole attachments, that's important because the way you deliver the technology is fundamentally different
right.
than there's not these big towers, right?
Right.
There's small shoe size boxes on light poles. That's not the only way, but that's one way that you can deliver 5G. There's also spectrum issues. How do you use the technology? And with 5G, we want to have competition. We don't just want one company to be in charge. We want to make sure that we have policies like One Touch Make Ready, where, you know, everybody who wants to deliver 5G can get access to a street pole. So we want it from the beginning to be competitive technology, to allow multiple players, but it also has a high level of investment because you have to have spectrum, you have to have the ability to deliver a high-speed technology, and then you want to enable all of the service providers. That's really key because that's where all the app developers and all the, you know, innovators come into play because they have to think of the new business models and what are they going to offer. And it's not just about giving people access on the phones. It's about getting all of the devices connected, all of the industries connected. So it's really this quantum leap where we're going.
One of my concerns is that non-urban
right.
areas
right.
do not have enough access to good, consistent, persistent
Correct.
Broadband. 5G going to enable that to spread quicker?
Well, let's hope so, because there's a couple of things where it's really important about rural areas. So one of the first challenges is that you have cases where you'll have certain cities who will say, oh, you know, we're in financial distress and there are these carriers who want to put up the infrastructure. Let's shake them down for some money so we can cover some of these debts. That may be fine in the short run for that city, but that means there's less money to put infrastructure in rural areas. There's part of the good thing about the technology is that 5G can use spectrum that before was not able to be used by other mobile technologies. So, for example, low-band spectrum, which can be used to go long distances, that's what we used for TV in the past. I mean, it's like a technological miracle. We've recovered the old television, if you remember, the rabbit ears. You can get the TV through the air. We're now recovering that low-band spectrum to be used for mobile services. So that is a fantastic thing for the wide-open spaces
right.
where there's not a lot of people living, not a lot of industry, so you can deliver data there. Now, the downside is you can't deliver as much, but you can still use it. So that's a good thing.
That is.
The other issue is, so high-band spectrum, you know, is particularly used for satellite. Nobody thought that could be used for commercial mobile service. We're now repurposing that. You know, has lots of high data, but in the past was only used for, you know, things out in the outer space, right? And then, of course, mid-band spectrum, which is what you call the Goldilocks band, that has the best combination of both the distance and the throughput. So today's carriers are competing not just in the marketing or whatever. They are competing in fundamentally different spectrums, fundamentally different, like, hard technologies and the ways they put it together. And that is really something truly exciting and transformative. So it's not like, oh, there's just one pipe in the ground. We are actually repurposing different parts of the radio spectrum to deliver services. And now some companies will say, hey, I'm going to focus on serving industry, or I'm going to work on this segment, or I'll work with consumer segment. So you have more diversification. And the least aspect that we may be worried about are mobile phones. 5G will be more about connecting everything.
Okay.
But the last point I want to tell you is that where I think we need to do better as a nation is that we have especially you can look at California, which has 4 in every 10 people are impoverished or living at or below the poverty line. You have, you know, 10 million immigrants. This is a state which is not taking advantage of the economic models that third world countries use to get broadband to the poorest people. And that is, you know, we're going to talk about our trigger word here, net neutrality. But basically, the amount of data that we need to give people the basic sort of social service they need, telemedicine, to be able to get it, to apply for a job online, to get the bus schedule, to have weather information, you know, all these sort of things we take for granted, that we can enable today with existing technologies for very little money. But it requires that we let go of a regulatory prejudice. We have to be able to use two-sided market. We have to allow some data to be free, some data to be discounted, some data to be subsidized. You know, for example, why should anybody have to pay to go to a .gov website? You know, IRS.gov. Should you have to pay for the data to pay your taxes? That would be a huge benefit, and was something we don't do today because we have this kind of a religion that all data is equal. And actually, it's not, because we have socially valuable data, which is has more value than entertainment data. I mean, that's just my opinion. There may be some people who disagree, but I want to prioritize that data, which will help the poor, which will help people come out of poverty, which helps create social outcomes that were more healthy. We don't allow the business models today, which would have a basic set of universal act services we could access. That's just a matter of business model. It's just a matter of regulatory freedom to do it. And it's done in 60 countries around the world. There's no reason why we can't.
We're speaking with Roslyn Layton. She's the author of a new study out called Tech Policy and the Midterm Election. We've kind of veered out of our lane, but that was on purpose because I wanted to ask Roslyn about some other things, including 5G infrastructure. And we're going to move to net neutrality in just a minute. But you landed on what is happening around the world. And that was a big question that came up when I was reading your paper. What are other industrialized nations doing when it comes to, quote unquote, net neutrality?
Nations of the world who have net neutrality rules, they have enshrined them in Congress or their parliaments or whatever their democratic institution. And that, I think, is for the United States a key stumbling block. The last time that Congress weighed in on the internet was 1996,
right? That's
22 years ago. It's a long time. And so we need to make a proper law that says this is a net neutrality law, this is what it is, this is what it does. And there has been a resistance to do that, I'm sorry to say, from the Democrats. They don't like what Republicans have proposed. But on the other hand, we're still having this litigation after years. And now we have an issue where states are trying to make their own internet policy. Mm-hmm. It's a very bad idea because that violates the Constitution, but it also creates a very fragmented nation. And so you'll have cases where people wouldn't be able to offer services, or, you know, you have a kind of balkanization of the internet in America, which exactly the opposite of why did we win? Because we had a single market from the beginning with a common language and a common currency, and you could put up your app in, you know, Nebraska, and it was available the same day in Maine. And, you know, that has been the strength. And if California is going to make a policy and the other states don't, that's a problem. But it's not right for Californians to decide for the rest of America. We have to do it, you know, in a democratic way where we all get, you know, a choice inside of the Congress. But
yeah.
In any case, the key difference, of course, is the other countries have been down the road. They went through the litigation and they said, no more of this. We have to make a proper law where we empower the regulatory authority in the proper way. And that's how we do it. There is no other way around it.
I think where you sit as an evidence-based tech policy expert and politically speaking, I think you're in a tough spot, right? Because, yeah, I agree with you that if California – well, look, California led the way on fuel efficiency too. So there is a precedent here that the rest of the nation can learn sometimes when it comes to California policies.
Right.
Not always.
Right, right.
But at the same time, I think that what you're talking about, if states do different things, it's hodgepodge. You're right. It's going to be really – chaotic, really, to do business in that atmosphere. But at the same time, on the right-hand side of the political spectrum, which I think is more of a horseshoe, but we can get into that later, it seems like that is anti-states' rights, in a way. It's tough to be where you are because even
So let me take that piece about the states' rights.
Okay.
Because there are, from going back to our Constitution, there were very clear things that where they said there were states' rights. And interstate commerce was something, our 10th Amendment, where basically they said, you can't have one state make commerce more difficult than other states. We have to be able to have interstate commerce. And if the Constitution doesn't discuss it, we leave it to the states. But we have made federal laws about communications policy because we accept that getting everybody connected or having a world where communications is available to all Americans, that outweighs the interests of any one state. So there are two important things to keep in mind. One is, you know, interstate commerce leaves freedom to the states to some extent, but our national communications policy demands that we have a uniform policy because we value all Americans being able to connect to the internet or the telephone network or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. The one other issue that is very concerning to me about California's approach is in order to do it, the regulators will have to do deep packet inspection because California can only regulate its own internet economy, and then they will have to differentiate if the traffic is originating from a server in California versus a server in another state. So I am very concerned that if California would go through with its law and then they'd have to fight it in court for the constitutional and other legal reasons, but in a practical way, in order to make it work, they'll have to do this surveillance on their own citizens. And that, I think, is even worse than the problem they're thinking that they're trying to solve. Now, remember, if we go into the world of 5G, it's going to matter a lot less because you can cancel your cable subscription. You can get more data, more speed, more throughput through the air than you can through the ground. So you may not care about, you know, net neutrality because you're going to have even more competitive options.
Well, Rosalind, I'm running low on time, unfortunately, so I'd like to...
Sure, no problem.
We covered a lot of what was in your paper, which I think is a very important paper. I'm wondering, just my final question for you would be, within your circles, American Enterprise Institute, a right-leaning think tank, evidence-based tech policy, what kind of reaction are you going to get on the right-hand side of the political spectrum when it comes to this paper? Are you reaffirming something, or are you giving them something else to think about?
In this paper, I've really tried to point out the strengths and weaknesses of both parties. And that was important to me because it's a nonpartisan institute. And also, AEI doesn't have positions. Only the scholars have positions. So within AEI, we have never Trumpers. We have forever Trumpers. We have Democrats. So we actually have a lot of different people. So this is my goal to try to put tech policy more on the map, because I would say the downside for many Republicans or conservatives is that they don't have tech policy in the sense that they're much more focused on an overall rule of law approach that should apply to everything. I think there's a certain benefit, but there is a blind spot because our economy is becoming increasingly technological and tech policy matters. The second thing is the downside for Republicans is they don't focus on millennials. They don't have, as far as I can tell, they don't have a good strategy, and that I think that's a blind spot for them. But I want to see the competition of ideas. If we just have, you know, one party all the time, we might not get the best ideas. And
right.
It's both parties have to pull themselves together to create real ideas and have a competition about it. And historically, that's what we did and why our tech policy was so bipartisan, because we had smart people on both sides of the aisle and they had a you know, an evidence-based conversation and made good policy. You know, it's important that we keep up that tradition.
And that's what we're trying to do right here. Rosalind, I tell you what, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for this paper. We need to talk again in a more macro way around net neutrality, because I have a feeling you and I could get spirited in that sense.
We definitely can. We know we can.
We've done it on Twitter already, haven't we?
That's right. Thank you so much.
That was Rosalind Layton. Rosalind is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Her new paper, Tech Policy and the Midterm Elections, dwells on hot-button tech issues like net neutrality and the more foundational tech stuff like the 5G that's coming down the pike. For a link to Rosalind's work, please check for a link in the show notes article for this week. It's at kgoradio.com. Coming up, we talk about the 21st century and how Congress has not checked its calendar, apparently. 18 years in, and we still don't have a uniform approach to digital commerce, digital distribution, e-retail, etc. The 21st Century Internet Act would ban blocking, throttling, paid prioritization, and eliminate all questions of jurisdiction. Supported by Democrats, only one Republican has joined the bill, Representative Mike Kaufman from Colorado. The bill will need dozens more to bring it to the floor of the House for a vote. There's another 21st century update in the offing as well. Congressman Ro Khanna's 21st Century Integrated Digital Experience Act, or IDEA. IDEA will lower federal costs and increase efficiency by digitizing government processes and establishing minimum standards for federal websites, including mobile-friendly interfaces in compliance with the latest security protocols. Coming up after the break, we speak with South Bay and Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna himself about these 21st century approaches.
I think it's going to eventually become law. It's one of those things that we'll look back and say, how is it that people were opposed to net neutrality?
That's next, so please stick around. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.
Thank you.